today, our topic is that of female diseases. And that's not to say that any gentleman who wanted to be present could not, because those things that we're going to discuss are things that your wives and sisters and mothers and aunts and your missionary contacts will all be interested in, and we need to be able to counsel all these individuals as their disorders come up. And I was wondering why I had so few men in the audience when we have such a large number of men who ordinarily come. I was just wondering why there were so few, but then I remembered it's because our topic is women's diseases. Now, I have a number of things that I would like to talk with you about, and I believe that some of the things that we talk about can be very helpful to you personally and to your missionary contacts and anyone that you should be counseling with, that these topics can be of very great importance. I'd like to start out with that of cancer of the cervix. I'd like just to tell you a little bit of the experience that we have had here. We have been working with cancer of the cervix here for a number of years, and we find that the very early stages of cancer of the cervix, before there is an invasion, that we have seen some very promising results from very simple things like garlic douche. Now, the garlic douche can be, the douche material can be found in our book, Home Remedies. If you will look just under douche solutions, you will find on page 77 a section on douche solutions, which gives a full gamut of what one can make in the home for the various things, and you need nothing more than you would find here. Notice on page 77 of Home Remedies that douche solutions start with just hot water, and that is a very good douche solution. It's good for cancer of the cervix. It's good for vaginitis, for salpingitis or pelvic inflammatory disease, and for a lot of other things, anything that you would ordinarily use just ordinary douching for, the hot water douche is good for that. But if there is a bacterium involved in it, then of course you could use garlic, or you can use the douche solution that you will see on page 78, that of Lysol. Lysol is not used much anymore for fear of hypersensitivities, but hypersensitivities do not occur any more with Lysol than with the pharmacologic agents that are generally on the market for douching. So I don't see any reason why one could not use Lysol for that purpose. When I was in medical school, Lysol was a very good postpartum perineal care solution that we used all the time. It is a very good deodorizer and can be used for any area of the on the skin that has an odor to it, where there is an odoriferous type of lesion, then it can be used for that to good advantage. But one can also use for vaginitis charcoal when there is an infection. Charcoal douching can be either hot or cold or warm, lukewarm. And in this way, one can get the benefits of the charcoal without any discomfort at all to the patient. Now, charcoal will take up germs. It will take up germs in the mouth, in the throat, in the vagina, in the intestinal tract. So wherever it is that an individual has a problem with a germ, then charcoal would be a good thing to take up the charcoal, the infectious agent. Now also, you will find on page 77 a styptic douche and comfrey and golden seal or two that can be used from that. An ordinary Pico tea could be used for any place where you want an astringent. Now an astringent is something that will pull tissue surfaces together like that. So if you have an area where, such as inside the mouth, where there are tiny ulcers, if you use something that has an astringent action, it will be pulling things together, pulling the surfaces together like that. So as it shrinks the tissue together, then the surfaces will be closer together and the cells can move over and bridge across and touch each other and cover an area that has been ulcerated or denuded. And so if you will remember that principle of the medicinal action of golden seal and comfrey and most any other tea that has an astringent action, you can use it for that purpose. Then garlic has a very definite antibacterial component. When we were checking garlic for its antibacterial component, we took some of the garlic and put it on a petri dish on the auger plates right along with the little discs that are impregnated with antibiotics to see if the garlic was as good an inhibiting agent for the growth of certain pathogenic bacteria as the antibiotic is. And we found that indeed it is, that it does have an actual antibiotic as well as antifungal and antiviral effect. And so garlic can be used in all of those instances. Baking soda, I like to use in its most applicable form for manilia or candida infections of the vagina. And since candida or yeast or manilia is most likely to occur in women who have a family history of diabetes, that is, their biochemistry is going to be toward the diabetic side, then I like to use the baking soda. Now, that's different from baking powder, you understand. Baking soda douche. It's like just the regular Arm and Hammer type of baking soda. You just take that and make up a douche solution, and it can be taken hot. Hot soda douche. That too is a very common douche solution when I took my medical degree over at the Medical College of Georgia. And there we learned a lot of various douche solutions. At that time, I suppose the commonest douching solution for a very infected vaginitis was permanganate. But it makes such a terrible stain that I never did enjoy prescribing that for my patients because they complained of it, that their clothing, their bedding or anything might be stained if there was any dripping of it on any fabric. Permanganate, just the ordinary permanganate solution such as might be used to soak the feet in when there is an infection in the feet. Wasn't it potassium permanganate? Isn't that the isn't that the material that's used, that purple material that turns the skin brown? When it's isn't that what that is? Mm-hmm. Well, that's the same thing that you use for the vaginal douche also. Now, the gentian violet can also be used for a variety of skin things. Can be painted on, just painted on liberally, and can be used nicely for that. But I suppose that douching solution that more people are familiar with than any other is that of a hot vinegar douche. Now, vinegar can be used hot or cold or warm, and vinegar douching is very good when you anticipate just any kind of ordinary bacterium other than yeast or manilia. And it's all right to use it for yeast and manilia, too. You will not go wrong with any of these if you use it in the wrong way. So if the person has a manilial infection and you give them a vinegar douche, you're going to do no harm at all. They're not going to get much, much worse. But they may not get any better. And if they don't get any better, then switch after 3 days, regardless of what you're using. If you start out with hot soda water douche, you use it for 3 days and they're no better, then try another. Again, if you go 3 days and they're no better, then try another. Go 3 more days, and if they're no better, try another. So I generally try it in that way, because you don't know what you're dealing with unless you have a laboratory at your disposal. And generally, when we're doing home remedies, we don't expect that we will have a laboratory at our disposal. But a word about going to the physician while we're on that subject of having a laboratory at your disposal. It's perfectly fine to get laboratory testing if you need it. No reason why you shouldn't. There isn't any reason why you shouldn't go to a physician if you need to. But you should draw a few lines when you go to the physician. And you are the one in control, at least up to the present time. You can direct what is going to happen to you most of the time. Now, there are certain diseases that you don't have any control over even now, and one is tuberculosis. Still, I believe in most states, if you get tuberculosis, it can be required by the state health department that you be put in a sanitarium for treatment for that. Some of you nurses are shaking the head. Maybe I'm incorrect on that. You don't know anything about it, it may not be. There was a time. INH and let them go. INH now and let them go? Times do change. Okay. INH is, that's an anti-tuberculous drug. Do you remember what that is, doctor, what the name of INH is? Isoniazid hydrochloride. So that's the name of INH, and streptomycin is sometimes used, and PAS is also used for tuberculosis. That's paraminosalicylic acid, and it's still being used as probably the best thing that we have so far as pharmacologic agents are concerned. All of them have very toxic effects, and during pregnancy, of course, are very contraindicated. So much for vaginitis. And I had started out talking about cancer of the cervix, but while we were on douching, we might as well have covered vaginitis as well. And that about tells you the story on cancer of the cervix, because the thing that we do locally is that of the garlic douche. We do use that specifically for the cancer of the cervix or charcoal. Now, with cancer of the cervix, we will also generally be using hot baths, hot treatments, making the fever go up, and keeping it there as long as the woman can tolerate it at about 103 degrees. If the cancer cell is taken up to the temperature of about 108 degrees, the cancer cell may die, usually will die in the laboratory. But if you take it up to 103 degrees, a cancer cell in the laboratory will usually not reproduce itself. And so we feel that we have done a good job if we can take the temperature up to 103. We have done what we can to discourage the growth of the cancer. At 108 degrees, if you get the mouth temperature at 108 degrees, the patient will be so uncomfortable that you will need to anesthetize them for that. They would not be able to tolerate it. And, of course, the anesthetization brings in another toxic drug which weakens the immune system and makes it more likely that the person is going to require more in the way of treatment. Now, the next thing that I'd like to talk about is that of fibrocystic breast disease. And fibrocystic breast disease has been treated with very promising results also here. And we have been very happy with our types of treatment for that. And I'd like to just mention some of the things that we have used for fibrocystic breast disease. Item number one is diet. Since some of the very same things that cause fibrocystic breast disease are things that cause cystic acne, then we recommend somewhat the same kind of program for fibrocystic breast disease that we recommend for cystic acne. Now, acne is of two kinds. It is the pustules and papules and comedones and macules. That's red raised spots, black heads, white heads, and little folliculitis. But also, acne can be deep under the skin with large, reactive lesions that involve the subcutaneous tissue of the face or the back and neck and chest as well. So these two different forms of acne are found, and the treatment is slightly different for the two. Although the cause may be the same, you will get a little better response if you with the cystic acne, the large lesions. If you really work with diligence on elimination of certain foods, and the same thing is true with fibrocystic breast disease. Now, fibrocystic breast disease has been reported in the medical literature several times to be associated with the use of a certain beverage and candy material. And what is that?
Chocolate,
and also coffee and tea and colas. Now, we start out recommending that. If the person is not already off these, and we hope that with a great campaign that's being done by some health agencies, that people will already know and will be off coffee, tea, colas, and chocolate. Because it's just these days, with all the knowledge that we have about these very injurious and even dangerous beverages and candy, it seems to me quite reasonable and proper that everybody all over the United States would just banish these things from their dietary. We know that coffee, tea, colas, and chocolate increase the likelihood of getting high blood pressure, getting cancer of various organs, getting a type of mentality that simply cannot get along with other people. And I think one of the important causes of marital problems, one of the important causes of the teenage rebellion, one of the important causes of discord in the home has to do with the use of these beverages. And people just get into an extreme position with their nerves, and they simply cannot take anything. And so if the breeze of your walking past happens to hit them in the face, they get very angry with you just for existing in their atmosphere. And if you pull up to a traffic light, those who use coffee and tea and colas and chocolate, they have the hand poised on the horn so that the very split second that the light turns green, the honking begins. And that's because of just cannot tolerate anything. It's just living right on the edge of what they can tolerate. And, of course, in the same society, you know that murders are going up because people just, they can't stand other people. And suicides are going up. They cannot stand themselves. And depression, hostility, and anxiety are known to be associated with the use of the caffeinated beverages. So it should come as no shock to us that it can have a cellular and glandular effect on people too. And so the glands of the skin and acne and the glands of the breasts and the glands of the ovaries and the glands of the urinary bladder and the glands of the prostate, these are all known to be adversely affected by these beverages. So cancer of the prostate, cancer of the breast, cancers of some other organs are known to be more frequent in people who use coffee. One cup of coffee, 3 times greater risk of cancer of the bladder. 2 cups of coffee, 2.2 times greater risk of cancer of the ovaries. And just on and on, there are just a lot of cancers that are associated in that way with the use of these beverages. So with fibrocystic disease of the breast, we tell people, leave them off. Now, another thing that is known to be associated with the glandular tissue of the breast is that of alcohol. For a long time, I have been and have taught being teetotalers. How could I, as a physician with any kind of sense of moral responsibility, teach anything other than being a teetotaler? Because alcohol is a protoplasmic poison. And unless there were some reason that I would need to use this protoplasmic poison as a life-preserving thing and some to stimulate the tissues or irritate the tissues in some life-threatening condition, I would certainly be irresponsible to encourage or endorse the use of alcohol as a beverage. And so for many years it has been my stance that since the human body is delicate and since alcohol is a poison, leave it off. It isn't good. And just about, what was it, 2 years ago or a year ago or so, hasn't been very long, the various cancer research centers have begun publishing information that even a moderate drinker, just a drink or so per week in a woman, can increase her risk of getting cancer of the breast. So we always mention that in fibrocystic breast disease as well, since fibrocystic breast disease or any other kind of disease of the breast increases the likelihood that a person will get cancer of the breast. Now, once one has the cancer of the breast and has painful, aching breasts, can't sleep at night, doesn't feel like walking very vigorously in the daytime, what can be done for such a woman? We have found that charcoal compresses have been very helpful. Now, we had a lady who was here at Yuchi Pines one time who had who was quite overweight, probably weighed about 200 pounds. And at that time, one of the principal reasons that she came was because of her fibrocystic breast disease. She had very large breasts, and we had demonstrated in the classes how to make a charcoal compress. And so when she made known on the first day that she was here, just after she had seen the charcoal compress demonstration, she made it known that one of the reasons that she was here was because of her fibrocystic disease of the breast. And so the lady who had done the lecture said, well, what you need to do is to make a charcoal compress tonight and see if it won't help you. So she made a little charcoal compress, a dainty little thing about like that, about 2 inches square, and placed that on a place where she knew she had a little cyst. So the next day, she saw the lady and she says, you know, I made that charcoal compress and it didn't help a bit. She said, it didn't? Well, let me see where your problem is. So she took a look at the problem and examined it well. The lady had taken off the compress and laid it over on the dresser. So she showed it to her. She said, oh, you're going to need one about a foot square. So that night she made a large charcoal compress and placed it all over the inflamed area. And the next morning, after a good night of sleep, she was quite delighted with the charcoal compress. So when you make a charcoal compress, cover not only the affected area, but the area all around as well, because often you need quite a generous charcoal compress. Hot and cold compresses.
How often would you suggest that?
Every night. Put the charcoal compress on every night until the pain and tenderness go away. It can also be used in the daytime, but anytime you use a moist compress around the clock, between changes, change it every 8 hours, and between changes, allow about an hour for the skin to get dried out so that it won't get waterlogged, and then the skin would develop some kind of rash if it gets waterlogged. Some people get a very uncomfortable, itchy rash if they wear a moist compress for a long period of time. Hot and cold compresses are also very good for fibrocystic disease of the breast and should certainly be used when one has that. The objective is twofold. One is to treat the pain and discomfort, and the second is to prevent the inflammation from coming back again and the cysts from forming. Now, if a woman has a cystic lesion of the breast, you can feel quite free, if you know how to do venipunctures, to drain the cyst of the fluid using the venipuncture setup. And it's very simple to do. All you must do is this. Let us say that here is the skin surface and the cystic structure is right here like this. And you have a needle, then you just stabilize that with your finger, with the fingers of one hand, and then take the needle and puncture it while you're stabilizing it, just like that. And of course the vacutainer is up here like that, and the tube is in here like that, so that you've got the vacutainer tube attached to the needle. The needle goes up in the tube like that. And you just puncture it, puncture the cyst and evacuate the cyst of the fluid. And those of you who know how to do punctures of the vein can very easily do that. It isn't difficult at all. Now, I always... If you have vacutainers, just use a vacutainer tube, just a red stoppered vacutainer tube used to collect blood that you anticipate will clot. Just put it in it, and then as soon as the fluid has been evacuated. Now, if the fluid is still running out briskly when you have when the vacutainer is spent already, then you know that you have more fluid in it than the, what is that, a 10cc size vial. So then you would just pull that off, leave your needle in place, just pull off that tube and put on another tube and finish the evacuation. It's very easy to do, not difficult at all. If it is a cyst. Now, if it isn't a cyst, then you won't get any fluid. Yes?
Are these cysts filled with white blood cells?
The fluid will usually have a few white blood cells and a few epithelial cells, and I was just about to tell you that once you get the fluid, don't throw it away, but take the top off of it and put a fixative fluid in it. Now, if you're in touch with a lab beforehand, request from them the kind of fluid that they will need to have put in that fluid to preserve it. But if you're not in touch with a laboratory beforehand, you'll need to go ahead and put some kind of fixative in it right then anyway. So something that you can use is alcohol, and about an equal quantity of alcohol to the quantity of the fluid that you remove from the cyst. Question is, would that work for the Bartholin's gland in the perineum? Probably not, because the Bartholin's gland makes a very thick secretion, although it can thin out quite a lot with the exudation of serum in it. Unless that becomes infected, in which case it will be probably too thick to go through a needle. Now, you might use a very large needle and a syringe, in which case you would get a large needle, like a 16-gauge needle, and stabilize the cyst and put the needle in it and then pull back on the syringe on the plunger with your last two fingers back here. All right, so much for that. Yes.
Invading something like that, you're not sure whether it's malignant or not. I always thought it was just better leave it alone.
Okay, the question is, what about disturbing something that might be malignant? Is the prognosis worse after needling or after biopsying than it would have been if you had just left it alone? There were some studies a number of years ago that indicated that the prognosis was worse. But in recent years, I've seen two or three reports that show that needling or biopsying does not particularly change the course one way or the other. And there are just as many that seem to be slowed down as seem to be nothing happen or the rate of growth increases. So I don't know that I have anything particular to add to that. If you're pretty certain that it's a cyst, then by all means go ahead and evacuate it and help relieve the situation. You can tell sometimes if a cyst is fluid filled by a process called translumination, where you take a little flashlight and just on the back side of it see if you can let the light come through the fluid filled cyst. All right, let's go to the next question, and I really have spent far too much time on fibrocystic breast disease because I have two big ones coming up, and fibrocystic breast disease is not so big. The next one is menopause. So if you have any other questions, several of you had your hands up, so just write your questions down, and we'll have another question-answer period tomorrow. But the next thing that I'd like to talk with you about is that of menopause symptoms. And menopause symptoms affect about 75% of women who go through the menopause. Maybe even 80 to 85% of women who go through the menopause. And it's felt to be due to a decrease in ovarian function. But somehow I doubt that. I don't know what it is. But I suspect that it has to do with the hormone axis and not specifically with ovarian dysfunction or a reduction in the activity of the ovaries. Now, my reasoning on that is that the woman who is postmenopausal does not have a less functioning ovary than she had before she was menarchic. And so it seems to me that if a little girl does not get hot flashes and all the other symptoms that are associated with menopause, that a postmenopausal woman should not be getting these symptoms from a low-functioning ovary, that it's something else. And I believe that one of the things that happens may be that when this whole axis does not work in a cyclic fashion anymore, that there are some other changes, maybe some suppression of some other thing that she has had that maybe reduces maybe her breath control or her temperature control or some other thing than that. We know that the hot flashes certainly come on more at night than at any other time. And hot flashes can come on for people who have respiratory problems or heart disease of various kinds or panic attacks and a variety of other things. So I feel that we don't yet know what it is that causes the symptoms of menopause. Menopause comes on at about the age of 50 years. 50 to 51.4 years is the usual age at which American women go through the menopause. Probably the earlier a woman starts her menstrual periods, the later she will enter the menopause. But some recent studies have thrown some doubt on that particular thing. Now, another feature is that a woman who enters the menopause can expect to have about 30 years more of life once she has menopause. So anything that would be persistent at the time of the menopause, we would want to take care of as soon as we can. Any condition that would be unwanted, we'd want to take care of that as soon as we can so that she won't have 28 to 32 or more years of misery from whatever that problem is. Now, what are the symptoms that one can expect from menopause or that are reported to be due to the menopause? And I made a list of some that people have described through the years. Headaches, insomnia, shortness of breath, dizziness, palpitations, the formication that women sometimes have. Formication is that sensation of ants crawling on or under the skin, especially in the scalp. They may feel this, but they may have it all over. And it may feel like ants because it stings. Nobody knows why. The hot flashes are, of course, the commonest single symptom. And these may be as frequent as one every 10 minutes to as infrequent as one per month. They may last from one hot flash to 10 years of hot flashes. And, of course, they do tend to occur more at night. They may last anywhere from 2 or 3 seconds to a couple of minutes or more. Depression is another symptom. Perspiration, increased perspiration, joint or muscle pains, and various abnormal sensations in the body, what we call paresthesias, strange things like tingling or numbness or some other abnormal sensation at some localized area in the body. Fatigue and irritability and the loss of scalp and other body hair and a reduced quantity of fat on the buttocks and in the breasts and generally in the subcutaneous tissue. And an increase in fat in the abdomen and on the upper back. So that we have what is called the widow's hump, which is fat. The widow's hump is the fat that's located high up on the top of the back and not the humpback, which is characteristic of osteoporosis. Now, there are some symptoms that are often ascribed to menopause that are not at all due to menopause. Schizophrenia has been ascribed to menopause. It isn't at all. A woman will not have schizophrenia at menopause if she has not come from a family of schizophrenics or had schizophrenia earlier in her lifetime. Various psychoses like depression and the like, these are not due to the menopause. Now, the treatment for the menopausal symptoms, often one of the things that a woman will be treated with is hormone therapy. And one of the principal reasons for the use of that is one of the symptoms which I have not mentioned, or a symptom which I did not mention, and that is drying of mucous membranes. And all mucous membranes may be involved. The eyes may get dry, so that at night in particular, a woman may feel as if she has sand in the eyes. And the mouth may get dry. She may wake up at night with a totally dry mouth and dry bronchial tubes and just be in a dreadful distress until she can get a drink of water, just feeling that her tissues are going to close up because of the unpleasantness due to the drying. And a woman may be given hormone therapy for this dryness, which also occurs in the vaginal area and in the urethra, and she may have what is called a urethritis, which will be associated with frequency, that is, she will urinate frequently, and pain with urination or tenderness, and urgency to urinate often. Now, the vaginal estrogens are absorbed at an irregular rate. In some women, they will be absorbed 100 times more efficiently and more rapidly than will be oral estrogens. And in other women, will be reduced in ability to be absorbed from the vaginal route. So giving estrogen cream is a little hazardous so far as the blood level of estrogenic substances is concerned. Estrone, which is one of the three principal types of estrogen production by the ovaries, is taken over by the adrenals at the time that woman goes through the menopause, and estrone production also occurs in men, also from the adrenals and some from the testes. Now, what about estrogens taken by mouth? Does that do a lot of good for women? Well, this research that has been published repeatedly in the medical literature is that only the vaginal drying and only there are two things, the vaginal drying and the hot flashes will be affected by the giving of estrogens, and that all other symptoms will not be affected by estrogens. That may be true, but if it is, then the estrogens have an extremely good placebo effect, because I know several patients who seem to have a very good handle on their medications who do feel that the taking of estrogens will increase their sense of well-being in a lot of other areas than those two that I have mentioned. And even saying that, my next statement is to say that I don't use estrogens. I don't believe that I have prescribed estrogens for the past 15 years for menopausal symptoms. I give just natural treatments, and the natural treatments are very effective. It isn't necessary to give the estrogens if you're willing to work along with a woman who has the menopausal symptoms and she is willing to work along with you. So what you do is, for the hot flashes, you give cool showers in the morning. That's number one. Give garlic tablets by mouth if she can take them. If she works out with the public, she may not want to take them except holiday times, and that's all right too, because there are other substances that can be used, although they are not as effective as the garlic tablets, but to use a diet high in the plant sterols is very good. And you'll find a list of the foods that are high in plant sterols on page 39, I think it is. It's either 39 or 49 in Nutrition for Vegetarians. You will also find a discussion of the menopausal syndrome on about page 100 of Nutrition for Vegetarians. The cool shower every morning, the diet, the use of certain herbs like alfalfa leaf tea and red raspberry leaf tea and licorice root tea, those can all be used. Now, is there a good reason why you would want to not use estrogen? And I think there are very good reasons why you would not want to use estrogens. One of those is that estrogens have been clearly reported in some series to be associated with the development of cancer. Cancer of the endometrium is one, and there was a study done some years ago showing that cancer of the breast was also associated with the taking of estrogens. Some recent studies have not duplicated that, but I tend to believe that it very well could, because as we all know, the fewer menstrual cycles a woman has during her childbearing age, the less likely she is to get cancer of the breast. And the current best theory on that is that the reason for that has to do with the total influence of estrogenic-like substances on the breast. Well, it doesn't seem reasonable then, if this theory is correct, and we don't have any theory to replace that one, so I believe that it probably is correct. If that is correct, then we would certainly have to postulate that the taking of estrogens would not make a healthy condition for the breasts. So I think leave it off if you can. Now, what about osteoporosis? If you are menopausal and you want to avoid osteoporosis, you will certainly have estrogens advised for you, estrogens and supplemental calcium. And on both of those, I say there is a better treatment, and it very well may be that estrogens actually increase osteoporosis. At least one very good study shows that osteoporosis is increased by estrogen therapy after about 2 years, that during the first 2 years, there is not much change at all. But that after 2 years, it works as some other hormones do, like cortisone and prednisone and some of the other hormones that can increase the risk of osteoporosis. So I have a fear of estrogens, and so I don't prescribe estrogens if there is any possible way that I can get around it. And, of course, you are aware that at least in premenopausal women, the use of some of these same estrogenic substances has been reported to be associated with hypercoagulability of the blood. And some of you may be aware that women who take birth control pills are more likely to get pulmonary emboli. And right here in Columbus, Georgia, Dr. Berry and I reported the first case of embolism that we knew of due to hypercoagulability of the blood due to the taking of birth control pills back in the early days of birth control pills. And it was after that, it was about 6 months after that before the first major report came out in the medical literature, but our report had already come out in the Muskogee County Medical Society Bulletin of pulmonary emboli, death resulting from multiple pulmonary emboli in a young woman who was taking birth control pills. She had driven from Seattle, Washington down to Columbus, Georgia, almost nonstop, and had developed phlebitis in her legs. When she got here, she went to her gynecologist, who gave her some various medications, and she just got worse from that. She had what he thought was pneumonia, and so he treated her for pneumonia, and she just got worse from that. and in 3 days was dead of pulmonary emboli. It was not pneumonia, but was pulmonary emboli from the coagulability of the blood, hypercoagulability. And I believe that it would be certainly to our advantage not to do anything that might cause an alteration in the coagulation of the blood with embolism. Any questions about menopause? What about osteoporosis and calcium supplementation? Will that be likely to help a woman, do you think? I think you're afraid to answer. What? If it has vitamin D in it, it might help. That's possible. Renee?
If a person is accustomed to taking a low calcium, a natural diet,
uh-huh,
the body doesn't require as much calcium, and then that person wouldn't need as much calcium when they get older either. They just continue to get their calcium from their food.
That's absolutely correct. A person who is on a low protein and perhaps also low calcium diet, or what would be considered low calcium. The average American woman takes 600 milligrams of calcium per day. 800 is recommended by the committee. And after the menopause, 1,500 is recommended. And certainly women past the menopause don't get that anywhere near that quantity on an average basis. And in a population drinking more milk than any other population in the whole world, how could it be that our population would also have the highest rate of osteoporosis in the whole world if calcium intake had anything to do with the production of osteoporosis? So I believe that it's very clear, and that when all the research is in, that it will be found that milk drinking actually causes osteoporosis, along with the use of red meat, both of which are high in phosphorus. And as we studied day before yesterday, you remember when phosphates go up in the blood, what happens to calcium? It goes down. And so, of course, it would be leached from the bones by the phosphates. So as phosphates go up, and we get that in soft drinks, and we get it in baking powder and a lot of other places where we get phosphates, and our high protein diet, all of these are associated with osteoporosis. And it is this that causes osteoporosis, and any other thought is, in my way of thinking, just wishful thinking. And will be shown to be, it is anti-physiologic and will certainly be shown to be not true. Did you have a question, Mary?
What about all this dryness? Is there anything?
All right. The vaginal dryness is a problem. And one of the things that I have found to be very helpful for the postmenopausal woman is what is called a perineal pore. Those of you who have had to do with the postpartum care of women will recognize that the perineal pore is simply the pouring of a fluid. It may be Zephyrine fluid, or it may be the Lysol solution that we mentioned, or any of the douche solutions that we have mentioned. It can be any one of those. And the perineal pore can also be plain water. And in recent years, it has been shown that plain water is as effective in postpartum perineal care than any one of the very expensive and complicated solutions that we have classically used as perineal care for many decades. So just use plain water. And if a woman postmenopausal with dryness of the vaginal mucosa will take hot water or cold water, not just mild water, but make certain that it's hot or cold, it will be a stimulus to the glands in that area. And that can be very helpful. Yes?
I was thinking about something you said. I read recently that it's really not calcium that you're lacking for osteoporosis, but magnesium you were talking about taking too much calcium. Does that reduce the magnesium?
Oh, yes. Very good. I'm glad you bring that up. There's no question about it that if you take calcium, it depresses magnesium. And if you take too much magnesium, it can depress zinc. And both of these are needed in the formation of bones. And so a nice, well-rounded diet, not high in protein, is the kind of diet that we should have in order to avoid osteoporosis. In addition to diet, there's one other thing that you need. Now, I recommend for my patients, if they want to avoid osteoporosis, become vegetarians. Vegetarians who do not use a lot of meat substitutes with their high protein content, and make no attempt to spike up the diet with protein. This is a mistake, and it always brings problems, because as you increase the protein content, you must increase certain other nutrients like zinc and magnesium and iron and calcium. And we are not good enough pharmacologists to be able to do that. So my advice is stay on a very plain, natural diet. Question?
Does a woman go through menopause who has had a hysterectomy?
Question is, does a woman go through menopause who has had a hysterectomy? She may or may not. If she has had her ovaries removed, she certainly will. But if she has not had her ovaries removed, she may or may not. Now, always with a hysterectomy, there is some compromise to the blood supply to the ovaries. So we need to account for that when we are telling women what their symptoms are following their hysterectomies. So it may be that even a woman who has her ovaries in will still have menopausal symptoms following her hysterectomy. Take one more question, and then I think my time is up. Is the next speaker here already? Already here? All right.
The effect of exercise to avoid osteoporosis.
Yes. Osteoporosis can be avoided by a proper diet and proper exercise. And, of course, both of these are needed to protect the body from a variety of other things. A thousand other health ills can also be very nicely treated by diet, a proper diet, same diet as for menopause, and the same exercise routine as for menopause. Those two things, that's all one needs to do to avoid osteoporosis.
This has been another special American Cassette Ministries presentation featuring Dr. Agatha Thrash, co-founder of Uchi Pines Institute in Steele, Alabama. International copyright 1988, American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. Duplication or transcription in any form is prohibited.